From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Paul Schrader wrote the screenplay for The Last Temptation of Christ and directed the new film Patty Hearst. He grew up in a strict Calvinist family that forbade watching movies. So when he was on his own, Schrader watched as many as 22 movies a week. Today on Fresh Air, I continue my conversation with Paul Schrader, who says that when he wrote the screenplay for Taxi Driver, he was living the life of its main character, Travis Bickle. Also today, I speak with Joey Ramone, the lead singer of the Ramones, one of the first and most influential punk rock bands of the mid-70s. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new Benefit album that features musicians like Bruce Springsteen and Brian Wilson performing the music of Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly. And film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Moon Over Parador. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Today we have the second of a two-part interview with film director and screenwriter Paul Schrader. Yesterday we discussed his two new films. He directed the film Patty Hearst, which opens September 23rd, and he wrote the screenplay for Martin Scorsese's controversial new film, The Last Temptation of Christ. Today we'll talk about Schrader's earlier films and about growing up in a strict Calvinist home in the Midwest. Paul Schrader wrote and directed the films Blue Collar, American Gigolo, Hardcore, Light of Day, and Mishima. He wrote the screenplays for Taxi Driver and Raging Bull, both of which were directed by Martin Scorsese. Sin, sex, and redemption have been recurring themes in Schrader's movies. Schrader grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, in a family that followed the strict teachings of the Calvinist Church. When he was young, he planned to become a minister. He didn't enter a movie theater until he was 17 because of a church ban against seeing movies.
Well, it banned what they called worldly amusements, which included things like card playing and smoking and drinking and dancing and theater attendance. And this came out of Prohibition days. And the ban was actually instituted in 1928. And, I once, as a child rather, impassionately queried my mother about this. I think I wanted to see some Disney film. And she said to me, it doesn't matter. The quality of the film doesn't matter. It's the industry that is evil. And so I think that was the position.
Did you have a sense of what you were missing?
No. And I'm actually very happy about having missed all those.
No, really? Come on.
Well, yeah, because, really? Because you are imprinted as an artist or as a person by, how you come to a specific field. And I came to films as a college student, and the first films I really saw or paid serious attention to were films by Bergman or Buñuel, Antonioni, Bresson. And that was my original imprinting in films. And my peers and coevals, were imprinted with Westerns and Disney films. And when they say, I want to make the movies that I loved when I was a child, they think about those films. And when I say that, I don't think about those films. I think about, the kind of childhood background and about the films I first came to love. I came to films as an adult and then later learned to love them as a child. So it has given me a unique perspective and a unique place in this business. And I've never really worried about anyone doing what I'm doing because no one has my perspective.
What's the first film you saw and what effect did it have on you?
Well, actually, the first film was a Disney film. Was Absent-Minded Professor. And I snuck...
Is that the one with Jerry Lewis or is that the Nutty Professor?
That's the Nutty Professor. This is the one with Fred McMurray.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And the one about Flubber.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, I snuck into the balcony and I sat there watching this. And I was wondering what all this fuss was about. And then about a year later... friend of mine took me to see Wild in the Country with Elvis Presley and Tuesday Weld. And I sat there and I realized, aha, this is why they don't want me to go. Here's the problem.
And what effect did that have on you, seeing that?
Well, I had developed a mad crush on Tuesday Weld.
And did that make you feel bad?
No, it made me want to see more movies.
Yeah, so what made you so passionate about movies?
Well, it was a very luxurious forbidden fruit. I mean, not only could you be a rebel and do something that upset your elders, but you could also wear the mantle of respectability while you were doing it. It was like having your cake and eating it. It was a rare opportunity, you know, to be a rebel without it, you know, having to do things like break into cars.
Did you ever see a movie and feel that it was having a harmful effect on you? Did a little voice in the back of your mind remain that said, this might hurt me, this might damage me in some way?
No, I'm pretty, you know, I have a pretty solid sense of who I am. I mean, there are movies that are damaging, and there are movies that I would not watch, and I would not want other people to watch. You know, I mean, society does have the right to protect itself against certain forms of violence and pornography.
So what kind of movie wouldn't you watch?
Child porn.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't watch violent sex. I would not watch amoral violence. Violence that is graphic just to titillate. Mm-hmm. It's kind of debasing, you know. I don't want to sound like a censor, and at a certain point, everyone has to make their own decision.
So some people, I'm sure, would have liked to censor part of Taxi Driver.
Yes, and I don't think that, that kind of censorship is in any way appropriate, you know. And the problem with censorship is that it's a case-by-case situation, and, you know, you can, there's certain things you just say, well, this is too much.
Paul Schrader is my guest, and he wrote the screenplay for the new film, The Last Temptation of Christ. He directed the forthcoming film, Patty Hearst. He collaborated on several films with Martin Scorsese. In addition to Last Temptation, they collaborated on Taxi Driver and Raging Bull, for which Schrader wrote the screenplays. He also wrote and directed Hardcore, Blue Collar, and American Gigolo. When you started to go to the movies, did you feel hopeless about catching up, that everybody had grown up with movies and you hadn't, and you had this whole wealth of movies to see before you could know them?
I came in as a film critic, and I went to UCLA Film School, and I remember my first year in Los Angeles, I kept a notebook, and I averaged, I think, 22 films a week for that year. And this was before cassette, so I had I was jockeying from one little university cinema to the next, and that's all I did for about 2 years, was caught up.
You had intended, I think, to be a minister, and then you became a film critic, and then a screenwriter and director. Why had you wanted to be a minister?
Well, it was just sort of part and parcel of the background. You know, those were the most respected figures, and I've always had this sort of proselytizing urge, you know, to go out and communicate and convert. And so that was rather natural.
Do you feel like you channeled that urge into movies?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious.
One of your movies, Hardcore, is about a father from a background similar to yours, a Calvinist, mm-hmm. in Grand Rapids. And this father's daughter runs away to the city where she starts working in pornographic movies.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if your parents felt like the father in this movie when you left home and started just working in regular movies, if the movies were so extreme to them in the first place that it might have been hardcore.
You know, I suspect they may well have. They've had to make some hard compromises over the years. So my mother's dead, but my father has had to, you know, in order to keep his family relationship.
Did they ever break the ban to see any of your movies?
I believe so, but it's not a subject that comes up.
Yeah. I was wondering if ordinary life or if the film world seemed exotic to you after leaving Grand Rapids. When I say ordinary life, I mean a more secular life.
You know, people came to Hollywood, who come to Hollywood, they talk about how tough it was. You know, before I moved to New York, I was in Los Angeles 14 years. And strangely enough, it never seemed that tough to me. because I had come from a background where people were not trying just to tell you how to behave. They were trying to tell you how to think. And you had to you had to fight off the mind control aspect of it. I got to Hollywood, and I said, these people don't care how I think. They just want me to behave in a certain way. This is no problem. So I didn't see it as that difficult.
To what extent have you kept religion in your life?
Well, I'm Episcopalian now. I moved to the less strict side of the aisle. And that kind of imprinting you have as a young adult is part of your permanent makeup.
Mm-hmm. You've been collaborating with Martin Scorsese on and off since the mid-70s. The first time you collaborated was on the film Taxi Driver. You had written the screenplay, and you asked, I think, that he direct the movie. And I think you wanted him to direct it after seeing his film Mean Streets. Right. What was it about Mean Streets that you knew was the right sensibility for the film you were making, Taxi Driver?
Oh, it's just a passion, you know. And also the perversity, you know. Someone who is willing to grab the thing, put it between his teeth, bite hard and run, you know. I don't want to use words we can't use on language, but someone who has the guts to do it.
Okay. Now, in Taxi Driver, your screenplay is about a lonely, alienated, psychopathic taxi driver. You've described the taxi as the perfect metaphor for loneliness, a man driving around the city in a steel coffin. And his alienation erupts into a bloody killing spree at the end of the movie, which he thinks of, in heroic terms, he thinks he's helping to clean the city of the pimps and the filth. I want to play from go ahead.
What's interesting about that is, in the film, he fixates on two women, one of whom he can have and one of whom he can't. And, of course, he wants the one he can't and doesn't want the one he can. And out of this dilemma, he decides to kill the father figure of the good girl, who is a politician. And when he cannot do that, he fails, he kills the father figure of the bad girl, who is the prostitute. And what's interesting, in his mind, there's really not much difference. They're both, there's these competing father figures. It's just that in society's mind, of course, he becomes a hero because one of them was a pimp and not a politician.
Sounds a little Freudian. Were you in Freudian analysis at the time?
No, subsequently.
Okay. Well, you wrote the journal, the diary, for Travis Bickle, the taxi driver, which De Niro just gives a brilliant reading of in the movie. I want to play some of that, and this is from the record, so it's excerpts edited together from the film. Mm-hmm. So this is Robert De Niro over a score by Bernard Herrmann with the screenplay by my guest Paul Schrader from Taxi Driver.
May 10th. Thank God for the rain, which has helped wash away the garbage and the trash off the sidewalks. I'm working long hours now, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week. It's a long hustle, but it keeps me real busy. I can take in $350 a week. Sometimes even more when I do it off the meter. All the animals come out at night. Buggers, queens, fairies, dopers, junkies. Sick, venal. Someday a real rain will come and wash all this scum off the streets. I go all over. I take people to the Bronx, Brooklyn. I take them to Harlem. I don't care. Don't make no difference to me. It does to some. Some won't even take spooks. Don't make no difference to me. Each night when I return the cab to the garage, I have to clean the back seat. Some nights I clean off the blood. 12 hours of work and I still can't sleep. Damn. Days go on and on. They don't end. All my life needed was a sense of someplace to go. I don't believe that one should devote his life to morbid self-attention. I believe that someone should become a person like other people.
The tone of writing in that seems so perfect for the character.
I love that line. I do not believe that one should devote his life in more self-attention, which, of course, is what this character does.
Oh, precisely.
Every moment of the day.
And the next line is just the most perfect line about alienation I think I've ever heard. I believe that somebody should become a person like other people. It's just the perfect expression of alienation. How did you know, not being a psychopath yourself, how did you know the tone of voice to get for this? It just seems just right.
Well, I wrote that script in 10 days, in two drafts. It jumped out of my head like an animal. And so it was a really cri de coeur. It was a cry from my heart. I've fallen into a difficult period in Los Angeles where I was living in my car and just sort of driving around. And having a lot of trouble sleeping. And finally I got a pain in my stomach, which turned out to be an ulcer, and I went in the hospital. And then while I was talking to a nurse in emergency, I realized I hadn't spoken to anyone in several weeks. And when I was in the hospital, I realized that that's what I was. I was like a taxi driver. I was like this person who was floating around in this car. And I got out of the hospital, and I wrote that script, like I said, in 10 days.
Did being in that car, driving around in it, almost living in it, increase your sense of detachment and alienation, being separate from?
Yes, I mean, particularly in Los Angeles, where I wasn't in New York at the time. You know, you do feel, like you are alive in a coffin.
Let's get back to the tone that you actually wrote it in. There's something almost Old Testament about the tone. Someday a real rain will come along and wash all the scum off the streets, but that's that apocalyptic sense.
Yeah, I really, you know, that was my first real script. I'd done one thing before, and I didn't know how you were supposed to write scripts yet.
But had you studied the journals of people who had become assassins or murderers?
No, I was actually surprised. Yeah, Arthur Bremer's journal came out after I had written the script. And I read it, and I was very surprised to find that the voice was almost identical. And I think that, you know, the reason that people, psychopathic people, have attached themselves to this film is because the voice is absolutely authentic.
Did it scare you that you were able to so authentically and so intuitively capture a psychopathic voice?
Well, you know, it scared me that I was at that place at that time. I mean, the person who wrote that script is long gone, and I don't even know if I would recognize him if I saw him.
I read that De Niro had you record the diary that you wrote. And I was wondering how you read it into the cassette machine, into the tape recorder when you made it for De Niro.
I don't remember.
Okay. Do you still know all the lines by heart?
No. In fact, I never go back and see any of the films. You know, I saw Patty Hearst when I handed it in April, and I'll never see it again.
Well, why not?
I don't like to go back. I didn't.
Listen, I've seen Taxi Driver lots of times.
I don't like to go. All I see is the bad. I never see the good. I just like to, keep moving.
Another Taxi Driver question: De Niro, in addition to having you record the journal entries, also wore your shirt, your boots, and your belt during part of the screening for the movie. Was that his idea or your idea?
That's his idea. You know, that's sort of the way he works. It's not this unique to that particular project. You know, he's done similar things in other films.
You had mentioned that you think one of the reasons why psychopaths attach themselves to Taxi Driver is because the voice is so authentic. What was your reaction when Hinckley said that he was... he had seen Taxi Driver and he wanted to impress Jodie Foster by attempting to assassinate the president?
I was in New Orleans at the time scouting locations, and it came over the radio that this kid had tried to kill Reagan. And he was from Colorado, sort of a white bread kid. And I said to the person sitting next to me, I said, "It's one of those Taxi Driver kids." And I got back to the hotel and the FBI was waiting for me. And in fact, it was one of those Taxi Driver kids. You know, the film didn't create them. They exist before the film and after the film, and they attach themselves to many things. More more, you know, it's actually sort of rare that they attach themselves to a good film. More likely they attach themselves to things like advertising.
You know, you were always warned about the danger of films. Did any of that come back to you after this?
No.
Not relevant.
I think art really works, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that it is possible through artifice to, you know, vicariously purge yourself of these dangerous feelings.
I want to talk more about your work, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Paul Schrader, and he wrote the screenplay for the new movie, The Last Temptation of Christ. He directed the forthcoming film, Patty Hearst. He also collaborated with Martin Scorsese on the films Taxi Driver and Raging Bull, for which he wrote the screenplay. Schrader wrote and directed Hardcore Blue Collar, American Gigolo, Light of Day, and Mishima. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Filmmaker Paul Schrader is my guest. Three of your films, Taxi Driver, Hardcore, and American Gigolo, are set in part in the sex trades. And I was wondering what your interest was in there.
Well, it's a lot of adolescent acting out. You know, I came from a rather puritanical background. And so, at a certain age, you've got to trash the candy store.
Is that what you saw yourself as doing?
Yeah.
When you started directing as well as writing, what was the most difficult thing for you to learn about directing?
Visual logic. Mm-hmm. I'd come from a background which believed that ideas were in the province of words. If you had something to say, you use words to say them. And it took me a long while to understand that images were also ideas and that they were not synonymous with words and that the image of a fork is not the same as the word fork. And it sounds rather simple, but I tell you, it took me a long time to figure it out.
Well, how did you learn how to think visually?
Well, I fell under the tutelage of a wonderful architect named Charles Eames, and that played a very important role in understanding that the poetry of and the logic of imagery.
You've also said that you had to learn how to not be too literary when you were writing screenplays. You said, I don't think a movie should have too many good lines, at most 5 great lines and 10 good ones. The rest should be absolutely ordinary and banal.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can overwrite a movie and start to call attention to the language, you know, unless that is your intention, unless language is the subject matter of the film, such as in a David Mamet production. But if you are trying to, you know, convey... a quotidien, a daily reality, and then you've got to restrain yourself from getting a little excessive in that area.
Pauline Kael, the film critic, was one of the people who was very influential on you when you were first making movies. I think she encouraged you to be a film critic instead of going into the ministry, helped you get into film school, and then you decided to write screenplays instead of to actually be a critic. What's the experience like for you now when she reviews one of your movies?
Well... we had a falling out a number of years ago. I think basically she thinks I should have stayed a writer and never became a director. And for some reason, she has not reviewed the last 3 or 4 of my films, which is actually fine with me. I regard it as something of a favor because I do not think those reviews would be good.
Why don't you think that'd be good?
Like I said, I don't think she feels I should be a director. I think she thinks that directors should be more sort of visceral people. It's all right for a writer to be cerebral, but not a director.
You said that you are no longer the same person who wrote Taxi Driver, that you don't really have those feelings anymore. At that time, I think you were really motivated by certain demons, by alienation, by loneliness. You're now married, you're a father, and I figured loneliness wouldn't have the same pull on you that it did then. Are there different things that motivate you now in your writing? Or even different demons that drive you?
Yeah, certainly. And you miss those old demons, you know, boy, because those are powerful engines and they really drive you hard. It was actually easier to write then because you had no choice. You were just trying to, you were running to keep the demons from swallowing you up. So today it's a little more difficult. You have to use your imaginative powers and your creative skills to a greater degree.
What kind of compromise do you feel that you have been or have had to make in your career between writing screenplays that fit your vision, that communicate the ideas that you're interested in, and you really do communicate ideas in your screenplays, and making something that's actually saleable?
Well, I mean, I want to communicate. You know, the movie business is the business of mass communication. If you're not interested in mass communication, you shouldn't be in this business. So, you know, whatever your personal visions are, you have to put them in the seat alongside the idea of mass communication. So it's just not possible to say, I don't care who sees this movie. I try to think of things in commercial terms. You know, how will people want to see and hear this? And so I don't avoid that. However, it is not possible to escape the idiosyncrasies of your own psychology. I remember when I did Cat People years ago, and I said to myself, now I'm going to do a film that is not personal. I'm going to do a genre movie, a horror movie, a special effects film. It's not going to be about me at all. Well, I look back now at that film, I think it's more personal than any of the others.
In what ways?
I just feel that the character of the zookeeper is really me. And when I set out to make the film, I didn't think that at all. So you can't really escape yourself.
Is that considered a liability in parts of Hollywood, that you would put yourself into it and that you would end up putting certain ideas into a screenplay, even unintentionally?
Well, it is a liability. And the fact of the matter is that I do exist sort of on the cusp of the industry. But that's fine with me, you know, as long as I can keep working and doing the films I want. And the industry understands very well that last year's cusp can very easily become this year's center.
Several of your films, like Patty and Hardcore, are in their way about leaving the family and about breaking away, either voluntarily or involuntarily, from what your life has been. When you left your home and when you broke away from the church, was that a wrenching experience for you?
No. I mean, it was more like the way a bullet must feel when it's finally discharged from a gun.
You want to explain that?
Well, I've been waiting a long time to get out of there, and I came out with a bang, you know, and I took off and didn't look back.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking with us. Paul Schrader's new film, Patty Hearst, tells the story of the kidnapping of Patty Hearst by the Symbionese Liberation Army. It's scheduled to open September 23rd. He also wrote the screenplay for the new Martin Scorsese film, The Last Temptation of Christ. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Richard Goodwin. He was a speechwriter for John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. His new book, Remembering America, A Voice from the 60s, is an insider's view of the presidential politics of that time. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring a removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the mid-70s, when progressive rock was about arty lyrics and flashy guitar solos, the Ramones were playing fast and loud 2.5-minute songs with titles like Teenage Lobotomy and Pinhead. Coming up on Fresh Air, we meet Joey Ramone, the lead singer of the band that helped start the punk rock scene. They have a new double album retrospective. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new benefit album that will help the Smithsonian Institute purchase the Folkways Record Company. The album features musicians as diverse as Bob Dylan and the Irish band U2 performing the music of Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Moon Over Parador, the comedy starring Richard Dreyfuss, Raul Julia, and Sonia Braga. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The nation's largest teachers union, the National Education Association, today endorsed Michael Dukakis for president. It was the fourth consecutive time the organization has endorsed the Democratic candidate. Michael Dukakis said today he supports spending $1 billion a year for Star Wars research, less than the amount currently budgeted for the controversial weapons program. But he said he believes testing and deployment of the system would violate the ABM treaty with the Soviet Union. Speaking to American war veterans in Louisville, Dukakis said the record budget deficit built up during the Reagan administration is a threat to the country's military strength. George Bush campaigned today at an Army ammunition plant in Texas. He viewed the destruction of the first American Pershing missiles eliminated under the INF treaty with the Soviet Union. More from NPR's Jim Engel.
Under the eyes of Soviet observers, two U.S. missile launchers were destroyed today. The rockets were fired to burn up their solid fuel as U.S. and Soviet dignitaries watched from 1,300 feet away across a clearing. Then the empty rockets were crushed to prevent their reuse. Vice President George Bush said it was one of the unique moments when the tides of history turned, a moment he said we'll be able to tell our children and grandchildren about.
This was the day we began to reverse the arms race. This was the day we began destroying the weapons of destruction. And this was the day that two great nuclear powers began to move together toward a safer, more peaceful world.
The vice president took two fragments of the crushed rockets, one for himself and one for President Reagan. I'm Jim Engel with the Bush campaign in Tyler, Texas.
The campaigns of George Bush and Michael Dukakis have set tentative dates for two presidential debates. The first is scheduled for September 25th at Wake Forest University in North Carolina. The final debate would be held on October 13th or 14th, depending on the length of the American League baseball playoffs. The debate between the vice presidential candidates would take place during the week of October 3rd. The House of Representatives has approved a measure allowing juries to impose the death penalty for drug-related killings. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
The capital punishment provision was attached to a bill designed to beef up drug enforcement, education, treatment, and prevention. The House attached a similar death penalty provision to a major drug bill 2 years ago, right before the midterm elections, but then the Senate killed the death penalty. This time around, in a presidential election year, the Senate took the lead. It has already passed a bill calling for the death penalty for killings committed during a drug felony, so some form of the legislation is almost certain to become law. Opponents of the death penalty provision argued that supporters were simply responding to political pressures and not listening to prosecutors who claim that capital punishment will make it harder to extradite drug kingpins from other countries. But supporters of the measure contended those arguments were simply confusing a simple situation, that it's time to get tough on drugs. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
President Reagan today asked three cabinet members to visit the West and determine what additional federal aid is required to fight forest fires burning in seven states. Agriculture Secretary Richard Ling, Interior Secretary Donald Hodel, and Deputy Defense Secretary William Taft will leave on their fact-finding trip tomorrow. Meanwhile, Yellowstone National Park is virtually shut down by wildfires that continue to burn hundreds of thousands of acres of land. A park spokeswoman says all major roads into the park are closed. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 2 points to close at 2063.12. Advances and declines were about even in trading of 150 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 1 cent. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, Arlo Guthrie, Taj Mahal, and Emmylou Harris. Sounds like the lineup for a benefit concert. Well, these musicians and a handful of others recently made an unusual benefit album, and rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
If you gather around me, people, a story I will tell about Pretty Boy floating out long. Oklahoma knew him well.
The music recorded by Folkways Records and its founder, the late Moses Ash, constitutes a treasury of 20th century folk, blues, and country music. When Mo Ash died in 1986, that recorded legacy was in danger of slipping out of print. The Smithsonian Institution expressed interest in purchasing Folkways, but it lacked the necessary funds, and thus the reason for this album called A Vision Shared, a tribute to Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly. The proceeds from the record will go toward the purchase of Folkways by the Smithsonian, so that the music of Folkways artists like Leadbelly and Guthrie will live on, both by itself and as an influence on new musicians.
Well, Jesus was a man.
That's the Irish rock band U2 singing Woody Guthrie's Jesus Christ. Guthrie intended to criticize those who use Christian teachings for worldly gain, but U2 plays the song pretty straight, puffing it up to fit the band's usual florid, overwrought style. Equally overwrought but considerably more fun is Little Richard's romp through Rock Island Line. On this cut, the 50s rocker is backed by the 80s rock band Fishbone.
Rock Island Line is a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line. The Rock Island Line is a mighty good line. The Rock Island Line is road. Rock Island Line is a mighty good road. If you rob the cops right away, you finally get your ticket out of station for the Rock Island Line.
Even on a benefit album, aesthetic standards prevail, and so it must be said that Emmylou Harris's version of Guthrie's Hobo's Lullaby is both sentimental and self-righteous, while the rendition of This Land Is Your Land by Pete Seeger, Doc Watson, and the gospel group Sweet Honey and the Rock is merely a good version of a song that any one of these performers might have improved upon on his or her own. Willie Nelson's performance of Philadelphia Lawyer makes you realize how much this so-called outlaw country singer has in common with Woody Guthrie's populist folk music. Probably the best single performance on this record, however, is Bruce Springsteen's version of Guthrie's Vigilante Man. Springsteen rearranges Vigilante Man so that it sounds like a lost Rolling Stones performance, and he sings the lyric with a muted snarl. So much of Springsteen's own music grapples with an attempt to understand the despair and hopelessness of dispossessed people that it's interesting to hear him abandon his usual solicitous tone for Guthrie's more bitter, pointed lyric.
I'd also like to say that if you thought this version was good and you have cable television, watch the video version of this album that Showtime will air on September 17th. There's a slightly different version of Vigilante Man played by Springsteen on that show that tops this one, and it's one of the most powerful, witty performances I've ever seen him give. The other startling piece of music on this album is Brian Wilson's radical reinterpretation of Leadbelly's Goodnight Irene. The former Beach Boy turns the song into a dense pop hymn and adds layers of irony to the composition in the process. When you think about Wilson's widely publicized emotional and drug-related problems, hearing him sing Leadbelly's masterpiece of suicidal despair adds a jolt of emotion to the prettiness.
Sometimes I live in the country, sometimes I live in town, sometimes I have a good notion to jump in the river and drown.
At its best, A Vision Shared transcends the status of well-meaning novelty item to add a few unexpected details to the work of contemporary musicians we thought we knew well.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. That's John Mellencamp singing Woody Guthrie's Do Re Mi, and this is Fresh Air. In the mid-70s, the Ramones helped launch the punk rock scene with songs that were short, fast, and loud. When the Ramones started playing rock and roll, they thought there was nothing good to listen to anymore. Everything was overproduced or junk. They saw their music as getting back to the roots of rock and roll. The Ramones were one of the first punk rock bands, inspiring new musical trends in both the United States and England. The founding members grew up in Queens, New York, and all adopted the last name of Ramone when they formed the band. They've been touring and recording since their first record was released in 1976. The Ramones have a new double album retrospective, so we invited lead singer Joey Ramone to look back at the band's history. You can't exactly call their new record a greatest hits album, since their music has seldom made it onto commercial radio.
Well, it's a best of the Ramones, but it's a collector's album as well, because a lot of the mixes have never been a lot of the stuff has never been released in America, like Indian Giver never came out here. A lot of the mixes are like various European mixes or English mixes or B-sides.
Have you been frustrated at all by seldom getting admission onto commercial radio?
Well, no. I mean, you know, it's a little frustrating. But then again, we came out with something entirely new in, you know, in 76. I guess when you're sort of the original, I guess it's a lot more difficult, you know. I mean, when you're pioneering something, I mean, you know, I mean, you're doing all the dirty work and everybody else just sort of takes, you know, like rips off your ideas and sort of, you know, kind of fuses them together for themselves and then they sort of break with your ideas.
Well, you know, as you were saying, the band sounded really radical and alien, different when it started, but I would think that in a lot of ways you really saw yourself when you started as being more related to the roots of rock and roll than a lot of the quote progressive rock of the time.
Yeah, well, that's what we're reacting against. rock and roll wasn't rock and roll anymore. I mean, it was fused with all kinds of things. I mean, albums became six cuts. You know, like, you wouldn't hear songs anymore. They were non-existent. They were, like, all kinds of jams and guitar solos and total cliché pretentiousness. I mean, it was... rock and roll was always simple and exciting and pure and from the guts. And if you listen to Buddy Holly or Elvis Presley or the Beatles or the Stones or the Who, I mean, that was exciting music. That was exciting rock and roll music. I mean, what... You know, what happened to it, it just didn't exist. It was a void, you know what I mean?
So you were playing really short songs under 3 minutes.
Well, with the songs we grew up on that, you know, that was rock and roll music were three-minute songs, you know? I mean, whether it be the Beatles or the Stones or the Kinks or the Who or, you know, the American bands, you know, Phil Spector. You know, songs were meant to be short. You know, they weren't supposed to go on for hours, you know?
I don't want to be a beathead no more. I just met a nurse that I do go for. I don't want to be a beathead no more. I just met a nurse that I do go for.
A lot of your songs were basically two, three, or four chords with a real thrashing rhythm, and I was wondering if the musicians in the band just played a few chords because that's all they could play, or it's because they all was it all they wanted to play?
Well,
or does it not matter to you?
No, because see, you're wrong there. I mean, yeah, a lot of the songs were like three or four chords, but then if you listen to Buddy Holly or Elvis Presley or Little Richard, those songs are three chords too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't understand what people are saying. You know, I mean. The rock and roll was always simplistic, and that's where the intensity is. I mean, that it's like short and simple and exciting and spontaneous. That's what rock and roll is, spontaneity.
You started out playing at CBGB's, the club in New York that became known as the center of the punk scene in the mid-70s. What were the initial reactions the Ramones got when they first started to play there?
Well, our first audience there were Hildy Crystal, who's the proprietor, the bartender and his dog. Those were the first people who came to see us, because CBGB's was a slum bar that nobody would come to, and they came to much later, you know. And it was like word of mouth in the beginning, you know. And then we got the Warhol crowd, you know, because the gays were always first to pick up on things.
When the word punk was coined to describe the kind of music you and other bands were playing, what did you think of the word of punk rock?
Well, we got tagged punk rock. We always considered ourselves rock and roll, you know. And to me, like, my feelings about the term punk is like an attitude. And, like, some people are punks and some people aren't, you know. And it's really a state of being, the term punk. I mean, Elvis Presley was a punk. Jim Morrison was a punk. Iggy Pop is a punk, you know. Mick Jagger. So if you're gonna call us punk, I mean, no, I'm not gonna mind. I mean, I think John F. Kennedy was a punk, you know.
When you first started singing songs like "Teenage Lobotomy," I think you were no longer a teenager. You were probably in your early 20s when that came out, and I guess I was curious about singing and writing so many songs with teenage type lyrics, yet not really being in your teens any longer.
Well, it's all state of mind, isn't it? I don't get old. I decided I wasn't going to get old, and I'm still the same.
I'm sure you were a great fan of Phil Spector's music. He produced an album for you. What did you think of what he did with your music?
Well, I really enjoyed working with Phil. I mean, Phil's a genius, and Phil's got his idios, which I think all talented people have to some degree. Phil probably has a few more than most, but it was very exciting. I mean, it was sort of an honor in a lot of ways. He came out of retirement to work with us. He felt it was that important to him, and I really liked the album, and I wrote most of the album, and it was enjoyable working with him.
a new member joins the band now, do they still take the Ramon name?
No, we're not going to have any more members. I mean, we're finished with members. See, Mark, he used to be in the band. He's our second and fourth drummer. He was in the band. He came in 78 after Tommy cracked up. Then Mark, he had a problem with alcohol, so we had to let him go. And we had gotten Richie, but Richie's wife wouldn't let him be in the band anymore. She wished the pants. So then Clem Burke stepped in as a temporary. And then Mark pulled himself together. He's been straight for 4 years. So, you know, it's only been drummers. I mean, the core of the band is the three of us, and that's the Ramones. I mean, without the three of us, there'd be no band.
As you pointed out, when the Ramones started to play, the music sounded really radical. Well, how does it sound now? Do you think it still sounds alien? Does it sound different? Does it sound more pop than it used to?
No, it's more radical now than it ever was before. But there's other forms of music now that didn't exist then, like speed metal and thrash metal. So like the Ramones, we like songs, we're song orientated, and bands like Anthrax and Metallica and Megadeth and you know whoever.
Do you like their music?
Yeah, I think they're great. I mean, I really like them because I like their attitude.
Joey Ramone is the lead singer of the Ramones. Their new album is called Ramones Mania. This is Fresh Air. Let's get a preview of All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
How are you, Terry?
Okay, what's coming up?
Well, we have reports from the presidential campaigns. George Bush witnessed the destruction of one of the missiles that was dictated by the INF Treaty, also following Governor Dukakis around. We have a big report from Tom Gelton on the arguments over Mexican land reform. But those, frankly, are not the hot items.
What is the hot item?
The hot item on the program today is a tape sent to us by one of our listeners of her dog singing along, accompanying the All Things Considered theme as it plays in their house.
Oh, it's about time. You got a good recording of it.
That's
those
right.
Stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's a new film from director Paul Mazursky. His previous movies include Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, Bloom and Love, An Unmarried Woman, and The Tempest. Now there's Moon Over Parador. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
It's a weird feeling. While all the other critics I know are telling me they didn't see anything funny in Moon Over Parador, I genuinely enjoyed it. Come on, they say. Did you laugh? Yes, I laughed. I even went to see it a second time, and I laughed again. It's one thing when a critic dislikes what all his colleagues swallowed whole. Then he has the luxury of disdain, of pointing out the crassness of the gimcracks that took his cohorts in, of explaining to them what they should have seen through, where their arms have been twisted and their heads turned. But when they all dislike the thing and you like it, and especially when it's a broad and silly comedy like Moon Over Parador, you may find yourself feeling like a yokel, a voice on a laugh track, a Geraldo Rivera fan, a rube. It's true that Moon Over Parador is spoofy in a way that may remind you more of Mel Brooks than of the silky ironies Paul Mazursky usually brings to his movies. And it's true that as an examination of the politics of Latin American dictatorship, the movie is something less than trenchant. It's even true that the movie's romanticism about Latin women and Latin climes probably works better on people who, like me, have been down there a few times and gotten crazy on the weird drinks they serve. For this and other reasons, I liked Moon Over Parador's weird drink jokes and its dead-accurate recreation of the mood of a beleaguered Latin American capital. And I even liked the incredibly exaggerated performance of Richard Dreyfuss. He plays a New York actor recruited by a Machiavellian prime minister to stand in for the recently deceased dictator of the fictional country of Parador. The prime minister, played by Raul Julia, seems to know just how to handle actors.
Are you an actor or not? This is a real guy! So was Richard III, Henry V. I saw Laurence Olivier play those men totally convincing.
This is a real man!
You did a very good impersonation on the set.
That was just a bit. It was a two-minute bit. You're crazy.
Where is your confidence? New York Times, Jack Noah, Sparkle, giving a fresh dimension to Richard II.
I was good.
Moon Over Peridor isn't a study of how power corrupts south of the border. It's really a keenly observed comic essay on the vanity of actors. For the Dreyfus character, the role of the late dictator isn't just the acting gig of a lifetime. It also provides the audience of a lifetime. The adulation of 500 blasé theatergoers is nothing compared with the adulation of 5 million screaming coffee pickers. Among the other perks is Sonia Braga, in what is easily her best performance in an American film, as the dictator's mistress. Then there's Jonathan Winters, ad-libbing like crazy as a mysterious American retiree, and all sorts of oddly cast retainers, including no less than Charo as the ultimate Latin chambermaid. Some may find Mazursky's in-jokes about acting insufferably obscure. I found them hilarious. And even when the film shifts from boisterousness to an elegiac hymn to Peridor's untrammeled beauties, I went along with it, partly because of the untrammeled beauty of Donald McAlpine's cinematography. Am I all alone in my affection for this movie? After you see it, write and tell me what you think. The address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Send him your movie review. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. And you can write anyone from Fresh Air at that address. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, the first of a two-part interview with singer Darlene Love. She was the phantom lead singer on some of Phil Spector's biggest girl group hits, like He's a Rebel, Zippity Doo-Dah, and Da-Doo-Run-Run. On our next show, Darlene Love talks about her girl group days and working with Phil Spector. Jazz pianist Dick Hyman returns in our performance spot to play and discuss the music of Errol Garner. And filmmaker Errol Morris's documentary on pet cemeteries called Gates of Heaven has just been released on home video. Our critic Ken Tucker has the review. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, WUFT in Gainesville, Florida. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.